KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
With the strength in the economy and also sticky inflation, we're going to have higher rates, and this is really sort of similar to where the economy was about 20 years ago.
Mortgage rates keep climbing. What does that mean for people who want to buy a house?
Today is Thursday, January 16th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, if Donald Trump keeps his promise to deport millions of immigrants who don't have legal status, where will those people be held?
Private prisons could make a lot of money.
Picture a direct line from taxpayer dollars to these private prison companies for the sole purpose of locking people up.
Also, a pediatrician has tips for navigating mixed messages about air safety with the wildfires in Southern California.
Trust your nose, and so if you're smelling that pollution, go ahead and put that mask on.
And we'll remember a storyteller with an eye for the unnerving, David Lynch.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Israeli-Hamas war, which may finally be drawing to a close, has dramatically reshaped the Middle East. As NPR's Greg Myrie reports, Israel's military has delivered powerful blows to several of its leading rivals in just over a year.
The ceasefire deal with Hamas in Gaza comes less than 2 months after Israel reached a similar agreement with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Both militant Islamist groups agreed to ceasefires after they were battered by the Israeli military and their leaderships were wiped out. Israeli airstrikes have also caused considerable damage to Iran, which backs Hamas and Hezbollah. While Israel has proved dominant militarily, it has inflicted massive civilian casualties in Gaza, greatly undermining the country's reputation. If the Gaza ceasefire takes hold, the latest round of Mideast fighting may be over, but the aftershocks are likely to play out for years. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President-elect Donald Trump's pick to lead the Environmental Protection Agency got a confirmation hearing today in the Senate. NPR's Michael Copley reports if Lee Zeldin is confirmed, he'll be in charge of enforcing environmental laws and advising Trump on climate change.
Lee Zeldin declined to say how the Trump administration might try to change environmental regulations, like the limit on tailpipe emissions from automobiles that the EPA expects will boost sales of electric vehicles. The former congressman from New York said the EPA's job is to protect the environment and the economy. Pressed by Democrats on climate change, Zeldin acknowledged that pollution from fossil fuels is making the earth hotter, but that he supports an all-of-the-above energy strategy.
In an ideal world, we would be able to pursue always the cleanest, greenest energy sources possible.
Zeldin said the American public wants pragmatic solutions to environmental problems. Michael Copley, NPR News.
Mortgage rates have moved above 7% for the first time since May. As NPR's Rafael Nam reports, more expensive mortgages make buying a home even more unaffordable for many Americans.
The Federal Reserve has cut interest rates by a full percentage point in recent months. Those cuts can help lower borrowing costs for things like cars and credit cards and influence mortgages as well. Instead, Freddie Mac said the 30-year fixed mortgage rate rose again this week. So what gives? In a nutshell, the thing to know is that the Fed determines short-term interest rates, but the mortgage rate is mainly influenced by the 10-year government bond. And the yield of that bond is rising for a number of reasons, including because inflation is proving to be pretty stubborn. Analysts say those bond yields are unlikely to come down meaningfully anytime soon. That means mortgage rates could stay high for a while. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
Stocks took a dip today after their major run-ups yesterday. The Dow fell 68 points. The Nasdaq was down 172 points today. You're listening to NPR. Even as some of the most damaging of the fires around Los Angeles are still burning, the question is turning to how and when the rebuilding will begin. Government officials are not just the planning for that, but the physical removal of toxic debris left in the fire's wake. However, questions from what should a rebuilt neighborhood look like, to what type of fire-resistant materials should be used, to how to go about the vast rebuilding itself remain unanswered. That is, death toll from the Los Angeles fires, at least 24, the fires causing tens of billions of dollars in damages. Vice President Harris signed her ceremonial desk today. The desk looks normal, but the top drawer in it carries a special tradition. More from NPR's Deepa Shivram.
Vice presidents since the 1940s have signed the drawer inside the desk. Harris picked up a Sharpie and added her name next to past VPs like Dwight Eisenhower, Lyndon Johnson, and Joe Biden, too.
I stand in a long tradition as the 49th Vice President of the United States, in a long tradition of vice presidents who have signed this desk, and I do so with great honor and with the knowledge that our work here has mattered. It has meaning.
She is the first woman to sign her name there, capping off her historic 4 years in office. The vice president turned presidential nominee has spent the last few weeks packing up her office, tying up loose ends, and attending to constitutional duties in Washington. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices fell $1.36 a barrel today, ending the session at $78.68 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. If buying a house is on your 2025 dream list, well, you may need to reconsider. Mortgage rates hit 7% this week. That's tough for those who've been hoping for mortgage rates to drop at a time when buying a home has proven impossible for many would-be homeowners. We're joined now by NPR's personal finance correspondent, Laurel Walmsley. Hi there.
Hey, Ari.
Explain what's going on here. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates a full point recently. Mortgage rates went up. Why?
Yeah, it's definitely not what homebuyers and sellers were hoping would happen. You know, when the Fed signaled that it was going to start cutting rates, mortgage rates did go down. The rate on a 30-year mortgage dropped to about 6% at the end of September. But then since then, they've been rising. And in these latest numbers from Freddie Mac, that average 30-year rate is now a touch over 7%. That's higher than it's been since last May.
Any idea why the Fed's cuts did not have more of an impact?
Well, in a nutshell, the Fed sets short-term interest rates, but mortgage rates really closely follow the yields on longer-term 10-year bonds. And the yields on those have been rising, in part because inflation has proven difficult to fully tame. Data just yesterday showed annual inflation ticking up for a third consecutive month. And bond yields are also being affected by all the question marks around the incoming Trump administration. Tariffs, tax cuts, deportation. If they happen, they're likely to drive inflation higher. Still, Sam Cater, who's chief economist at Freddie Mac, said these rising mortgage rates are simply what happens in this type of economic situation.
The economy has been much stronger than expected. And so therefore, with this strength in the economy and also sticky inflation, we're going to have higher rates. And this is really sort of similar to where the economy was about 20 years ago.
And in fact, these mortgage rates that economists are saying are the new normal, like 6 or 7%, is basically where rates were in the 90s and early 2000s.
And so what does that mean for the housing market?
Well, unsurprisingly, it has dampened demand. Applications for new mortgages were down 2% this week over this time last year. And that's significant because when we get the final numbers, 2024 might turn out to have been the slowest year for existing home sales since 1995.
Wow.
But more inventory is expected to be coming onto the market when the spring buying season ramps up, which should spur more sales. And Cater at Freddie Mac predicts demand to pick up again, in part due to what he called demographic tailwinds.
I think home prices and the real estate market will be able to withstand the higher rate environment because the economy is strong. There's a large segment of renters that are affluent enough and reaching their mid-30s and early 40s that want to buy. And so there's a lot of latent demand that's there that I think is waiting to jump in the market.
Still, that's not everybody. A lot of people are feeling left out here. Those high rates are combined with high prices, which together mean the numbers just don't work for lots of people.
So what advice do you have for people who do want to buy a house, despite all of that?
Well, it's tough, but there are a couple of things. I mean, one is to shop around to different mortgage lenders to see who can give you the best rate. Talking to multiple lenders really does make a difference. And of course, a lower rate means a lower payment each month. Second, if you're feeling frustrated by what you can afford, you might need to expand where you're looking and consider different neighborhoods or locations in your metro area. Prices can vary a lot, so if it feels like you're striking out, you might need to expand your search.
NPR's Laurel Wamsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now to California, where firefighters in Los Angeles are making progress getting those massive wildfires under control. Like many disasters, the fires have already become a target for rumors and conspiracy theories. Now, NPR has learned that Russia is using the fires to advance anti-Ukraine propaganda as part of its war against that country. NPR's Huo Jingnan uncovered this and is in the studio with me now. Hi.
Hello.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about this claim and whether there's anything to it.
So as we know, the fire has destroyed lots of expensive properties, including mansions and beachfront homes. So this particular narrative, what it alleges is that mansions of 8 Ukrainian generals were amongst the homes destroyed. So far, there's no evidence that it happened, and the Ukrainian government has denied it to NPR. But researchers say that it is part of a bigger narrative that Russia has pushed for years. Pro-Russian accounts regularly claim that various Ukrainian officials own luxury goods overseas, like yachts, villas, and in one case, a sports car. The underlying idea is that Ukrainian government is corrupt and does not deserve foreign aid, which it is currently receiving for its war with Russia. So the journalists have debunked a lot of those claims already.
Okay, but so this specific claim, I'm trying to wrap my head around it, that 8 Ukrainian generals were among those who had their mansions burned down. Where did this claim come from? How did it spread?
So fact-checkers traced this narrative to pro-Russian Telegram channels. One of these channels even featured a video doctored to make it look like it was from the Ukrainian government. Then accounts on other social media platforms such as X, as well as websites, repeated the story. A lot of these accounts and websites have a history of either being a part of or echoing known Russian influence operations. Darren Lillo is a professor at Clemson University and co-directs its media forensics lab.
It's just so typical of what we see from Russia and so despicable to take advantage of an ongoing crisis for their own ends.
You know, aside from undermining Ukraine, Russia also wants to sow internal discord in the United States. We see this both in this disaster and in the Maui fires in 2023. Uh-huh. Russian state media amplified American, often conservative, voices criticizing the government's disaster response. This didn't get much traction, though.
And this specific false claim, has it gotten much traction, traveled very far?
So it's gone a million views on X, with help from one pro-Russian influencer and then an American influencer. So we see that social media influencers actually have played an important role in pushing Russia's preferred narrative. For example, last year, the Justice Department indicted two Russian state media employees for funneling $10 million to pro-Trump American influencers. We reached out to these two influencers, though, to ask if they were paid or asked to promote the story about mansions. The pro-Russian one denied it, and the American one did not respond. But the big picture here is that Russia continues to try to covertly influence Americans, and that's an ongoing effort. Researchers say that Russia's top political goal is to control Ukraine, and it has not changed whether or not, you know, regardless of American elections. So it's going to keep trying to reshape American public opinion whenever it can.
Fascinating. NPR's Huo Jingnan, thank you.
Thank you.
Filmmaker David Lynch has died. He created off-kilter classics like Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, and Mulholland Drive, as well as the innovative TV series Twin Peaks. Lynch was 78 years old. Kyle Norris has our remembrance.
David Lynch's work was weird. His first full-length film was called Eraserhead. It's a surreal horror film in black and white.
In heaven.
Lynch started making Eraserhead in his mid-20s. The film initially got mixed reviews in 1977, but became a hit in midnight movie houses. David Lynch was born in Montana. He spent much of his childhood in Boise, Idaho in the 1950s. And Lynch looked like he stepped out of the 1950s with his messy pompadour of silver hair. He became established with movies such as The Elephant Man and the 1984 version of Dune. Lynch told NPR in 2007 he made them by focusing on an idea.
When I get an idea, I see it, hear it, feel it. It's like it just there in your brain. There's an idea, it comes to life. You fall in love with some of these ideas.
He would stitch ideas together, he said, and decide what they all meant. Like in Blue Velvet, a film from 1986.
Put your hands up, on your head, do it!
Lynch started with an image, a severed ear in a field. It led to a twisted mystery with sexual violence and a criminal underworld set in a picturesque small town.
What's your name? What's your name?
Lynch liked to explore American innocence through imagery, said critic Melanie McFarland.
The white picket fence, the girl with the saddle shoes, the homecoming queen, the clean cut FBI agent.
McFarland said Lynch pulled back that wholesome veneer
and gets at the darkness underneath all of it.
McFarland said Lynch did this in the 1990s television series Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks was a fictional series about the murder of homecoming queen Laura Palmer, investigated by a quirky FBI agent. Here, driving into the town that shares the show's title.
Lunch was $6.31 at the Lamplighter Inn. That's on Highway 2 near Lewis Fork. That was a tuna fish sandwich on whole wheat, slice of cherry pie, and a cup of coffee. Damn good food.
Twin Peaks was a mashup of styles, part mystery, part supernatural, and part soap opera. McFarland said Twin Peaks transformed television because it was cinematic and complex.
This is not a straightforward story. There were dream sequences. There were very elaborate ideas of identity. In a very specific sense, Laura Palmer was not just Laura Palmer, right? No one was just one thing.
McFarland said Twin Peaks influenced later shows such as Mad Men, The Sopranos, and 6 Feet Under. One of Lynch's masterpieces was the movie Mulholland Drive from 2001. It blurs reality with the world of dreams.
There's a man in back of this place. He's the one who's doing it. I can see him through the wall. I can see his face.
David Lynch was also a lifelong painter and was devoted to transcendental meditation. But he will be remembered for stories that were dark and unsettling, a style now known as Lynchian. For NPR News, I'm Kyle Norris.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Paramount Pictures, presenting the new film September 5. When gunshots are heard in the Olympic Village, broadcast history is made, based on a true story, in select theaters now, everywhere January 17th, rated R. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Air quality in Los Angeles has improved since last week when the wildfires first started. Some good news there. There are still questions, though, about how safe the air actually is now. So we turn to NPR's Alejandra Borunda with the Climate Desk for some answers. Hey there.
Hey.
Hi. Okay. So there is data, obviously, that people can turn to try to figure out if the air is safe to breathe. I'm thinking of things like the air quality index. Does that give you enough info to make a call?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the short answer is no, but it's a good starting place. So the AQI incorporates measurements of 5 different air pollutants regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, like fine particles and ozone. But the AQI is really designed to tell you about normal kinds of pollution, like car exhaust or smog. And scientists think that smoke carries different and potentially higher risks. So what several experts told me is AQI is a helpful gauge to indicate when wildfire smoke or ash is in the air, but it's not going to tell you everything.
Uh-huh. So what does it miss?
Yeah, it does not take into account many gas or particle contaminants that are produced during wildfires, especially ones that burn through structures like we saw here. Think of all the synthetic roofing tiles, the couches, the appliances, all that stuff that burned. Those can produce carcinogens like benzene or formaldehyde or asbestos fibers or metals. Michael Jarrett is a wildfire smoke expert at UCLA. He puts it this way.
Those are definitely a health concern, and there's no way to really prevent it.
Once those catch on fire, the contaminants get up into the air and then they spread through smoke and ash. And the other factor here is wind. If the winds shift, air quality can change really quickly.
So are you telling me, okay, yes, good news, the air has improved in LA. It may even look better, like brighter skies, but those carcinogens, things like benzene, they could still be in the air?
Yeah, this is what's tough is honestly, we don't know. It's not really measured consistently. The fire isn't burning houses and cars anymore, so that's really good. But the old ash that spread all over the city, that can still get picked up and spread around again by any new wind. So what experts told me was keep close track of the AQI, because that will at least tell you if there's stuff in the air. And if there is, it's probably safe to assume that there's some nasty stuff too. But it's not like last week. And several experts suggested looking at purple air maps for really neighborhood scale information. Or you could even go more small scale, like wildfire smoke expert Luke Matros from Colorado State University. He always has personal air quality monitors on hand, like these little ones that clip onto a backpack.
Knowledge is power. I have a whole bag of them that I carry with me.
Again, these won't tell you about the toxic contaminants, but they can give you a rough sense of the risk.
Bottom line, then, what is the menu of things that people should be thinking about doing to protect themselves, protect their families?
Yeah, I think the good news is that it's pretty straightforward. Keep track of AQI as an indicator again. Run the air filters you have in your house and wear masks to help with particulates. Those can help with things like asbestos, for example. Activated carbon filters can help with the gases like benzene. But overall, I think this is the message. There's a saying, the dose makes the poison. So if you're worried, err on the side of caution. Lisa Patel is a pediatrics expert at Stanford, and she says that could mean limiting time outside right now. And
trust your nose. And so if you're smelling that pollution, go ahead and put that mask on.
As for schools, Patel says lots actually updated their HVAC systems during the COVID-19 pandemic, but you could always get some portable air filters for your kids' classrooms.
All righty. Thank you, Alejandra.
Thanks so much.
That's NPR's Alejandra Borunda.
Deb Holland says her tenure leading the Department of the Interior has brought historic change to Indian country, including billions in federal money for tribes, for everything from water to improved public safety. It's not clear how the new Trump administration will work with tribes and tribal lands, but NPR's Kirk Sigler looks at what Holland, the first indigenous cabinet secretary, leaves behind.
At a farewell speech in Washington this week, Interior Secretary Holland reflected on President Biden's recent formal apology for the U.S. government's historic assimilation policies and its Indian boarding schools. Starting in the 1800s, children were separated from families, some abused or worse. She spoke about going with the president to one of the most notorious boarding schools in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, now a national monument.
As I stood next to the president, I felt the power of our ancestors who persevered through unthinkable odds so that we could all be there that day.
Holland's grandparents and her mother were sent away, a trauma she brought up in an interview with me just before the November election. Holland says her Road to Healing tour across Indian country was a turning point.
It's an important piece of our history that every single American should know about. It's a painful part of our history.
Tribes had huge expectations for Holland. She pushed to bring them to the table on all lands decisions and to right a legacy of historic wrongs in Indian country, like broken treaties.
People can't unlearn this history now. My worry is that, you know, we're not going to act fast enough to, you know, continue responding to the ongoing consequences today.
Robert Maxim is a citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and a Brookings Institution fellow. He wrote a congressionally funded report after the election warning that it's likely now up to states to continue with Holland's reforms.
And I'm basing really a lot of that on the record of the first Trump administration.
Maxim worries the next Trump administration will slow walk the creation of monuments and protected lands and cut funding for programs like Head Start. But on the other hand, he says Holland's likely successor, former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, has close relationships with tribes. And a push for more oil and gas drilling on federal and tribal land is certain under the new administration. Holland made conservation a hallmark of her tenure.
I think in this era of this really terrible climate crisis that those are considerations that need to be made when we're managing our public lands.
The secretary says she's proud of her work, making tribal consultation a priority on every decision. But this is where things could get a little thorny when it comes to her legacy. Tribes in Nevada blame Holland for not intervening to do more to stop lithium mines approved on land they consider sacred. And there are gaming matters between tribes that still have hard feelings. On the West Coast, some are angry over a late-hour decision allowing some tribes to open casinos off their reservations.
When she became secretary, I was very, very excited, and that went away very quickly.
Carla Keene is chair of the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Indians, which sued the Interior Department over its approval of another tribe's off-reservation casino near Medford, Oregon. Keene worries it will compete with her tribe's casino that funds essential services.
And I wish that she would have came out and visited our homelands when she was invited. And I wish that she would have taken the time to learn about our tribes and not been so afraid of somebody being mad at her.
The department didn't respond to her request for comment on this. Secretary Holland did tell me there's always someone disagreeing with how she leads an agency that controls 20% of America's land. And zooming out, activists in Indian country generally revere Holland for respecting their history, a change they say will be hard for any future administration to undo. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Trump's inauguration will mark the end of a chapter for his political opponent, Kamala Harris. She'll no longer hold a seat in office, but she may continue to influence politics. What's to come for the vice president? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, there is an upside to the lack of snow this winter in New England, ice skating.
We'll lace up our skates on a lake in Maine.
We're truly cherishing this moment, but our lakes are unequivocally not freezing as much in the winter.
After this summary of the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Senate Democrats are making another push to extend the deadline that would ban the popular video sharing app TikTok. Senator Ed Markey says he and other Democrats have sent President Biden a letter asking him to extend it by 90 days.
170 million Americans. That's over half of our population. It's 65% of all adults in the United States are on TikTok. And to put that in perspective, that TikTok user base exceeds the Super Bowl's viewing audience by 50%.
Supporters of the ban say the Chinese-owned site poses a threat to national security. Opponents argue it violates free speech rights. TikTok could be banned on Sunday. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is sending the state's attorney general to Washington, D.C. Ashley Moody will replace Senator Marco Rubio if he's confirmed to be the next Secretary of State. Adrian Andrews of member station WFSU has more.
Moody would serve in the Senate until 2026 if the Senate approves President-elect Donald Trump's nomination of Rubio. Moody has been a firm supporter of Governor Ron DeSantis and the Trump administration since taking office in 2019. She expressed her willingness to continue the fight towards illegal immigration reform during her acceptance speech.
I have one message right now to President Trump and to my new colleagues on the United States Senate. America first. Let's get it done.
DeSantis, in his announcement, said he wanted a senator who can work with Trump to help cut excessive spending and strengthen the nation's border. For NPR News, I'm Adrian Andrews in Tallahassee.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 68 points. This is NPR News. Hall of Fame baseball announcer Bob Uecker has died at the age of 90. Chuck Quernbach of member station WUWM reports Uecker was the main voice of the Milwaukee Brewers radio broadcasts for 54 seasons.
Bob Uecker played Major League Baseball for six seasons but made a long career out of downplaying his talent. Even in 2021, Uecker told about being an amateur pitcher in the 1950s and having a tryout before the Milwaukee Braves pitching coach.
He said, "Now let me see your good fastball." I said, "I have been throwing my good fastball." He said, "Well, then I recommend you get a job." I swear to you, that's what he told me.
Uecker said he soon switched to playing catcher. Uecker's humor also landed him many appearances on The Tonight Show, TV commercials, the show Mr. Belvedere, and two Major League movies. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
College basketball has announced that it will now pay Division I women's teams who take part in March Madness games. The NCAA says the teams will receive performance units for every game they play in the tournament. Men's college basketball has been part of revenue-sharing plans for years. The National Women's Championship game drew record attendance in 2024, with nearly 19 million viewers tuning in to watch. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. When President-elect Trump takes office on Monday, he has said one of his first priorities will be a mass deportation effort. An estimated 11 million immigrants are in the U.S. without legal status. And Trump's plan raises a variety of concerns, from civil rights to logistics. It's not clear where officials would house detainees before they're deported. NPR criminal justice reporter Meg Anderson has been looking into the options the administration could use. Hi there.
Hey, Ari.
Where could the Trump administration put immigrants facing deportation?
Yeah, so of course, one of the first places people think about are the nation's prisons and jails. And U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, otherwise known as ICE, has more than 100 detention facilities across the country, the vast majority of which are owned or operated by private prison companies. They contract with ICE. And a spokesperson for one of them, Geo Group, gave me a statement saying that they're investing $70 million towards more housing, transportation, and monitoring capabilities. On the government side, last year, the Biden administration began exploring the possibility of adding facilities in at least 18 states, and that could help lay the groundwork for the Trump administration. And some state officials are also saying that they're eager to help. An Arizona lawmaker told me he plans to introduce a bill to offer ICE two empty state prisons there. And Texas officials promised Trump 1,400 acres to use as a detention camp.
What could those private prison companies you mentioned stand to gain from this mass deportation effort?
Yeah, so private prison companies make billions of dollars in revenue through their contracts with ICE, and they stand to make more. The day after Trump won his second term, the stock value for two of those major companies, Geo Group and CoreCivic, shot way up. Eunice Cho, she's an attorney with the ACLU, says that is worrisome.
Picture a direct line from taxpayer dollars to these private prison companies for the sole purpose of locking people up in immigration detention facilities, where the interest of these corporations is to be accountable to their shareholders and fatten their bottom line.
So both Geo Group and CoreCivic declined interviews with me, but they said in statements that they treat everyone that they hold in a safe and humane manner. And CoreCivic actually said that they're helping solve a problem that the public has made clear it wants fixed.
What about county jails? Do they have space? Could they make money off of this?
Yeah, so many immigrants are detained in county jails. They rent their space out either to ICE or to those private companies. And it's a critical revenue stream for a lot of jails, especially in smaller jurisdictions that tend to rely on those places, right? For money, for jobs, and plenty of sheriffs are willing to help. Brian Kozak is the sheriff in Laramie County, Wyoming, and he says his jail has more than 200 empty beds that he plans to offer to ICE.
They're going to be detained and held somewhere. Our jail offers pretty good resources to help people in their transition.
He says his jail is already funded, and so that money from ICE would be purely extra revenue. But, you know, actually around the country, many jails are understaffed already, and so finding enough manpower to make it safe to detain so many people would still be a huge challenge.
I mean, we are talking about so many people. What other hurdles are there when you're talking about mass detention on that scale?
Yeah, so there's the one of just, you know, manpower, and then there's sheer cost. The American Immigration Council estimated that mass deportation on this scale would cost more than $300 billion. For context, Congress allocated about $3 billion for immigration detention last year. Taking that into account with the manpower, the space, even all these plans that are already underway are nowhere near, what would be needed to do such a plan. And there are real humanitarian concerns. The government's own inspections of ICE detention facilities in recent years have found unsafe conditions, negligent medical care, and lax oversight. I should say that Trump's transition team and also officials at ICE did not respond, though, to my request for an interview.
NPR's Meg Anderson, thank you.
You're welcome.
You are what you eat, as the saying goes. That is why researchers who study our most ancient ancestors, early humans, have wondered about their diets. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on a new study that used some very old teeth to see what was for dinner millions of years ago.
Researchers have long been able to reconstruct ancient diets to a certain extent. They can look inside of hardy tooth enamel to check for chemical signatures linked to the consumption of different types of plants, like grasses versus trees.
Just to get an idea, like who was more in an open grassland savanna, who lived more probably in a more forested environment.
Tina Ludica is with the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Germany. She says the type of chemical tests used to look at plant consumption can't tell you anything about meat.
And I was always very frustrated, like many of us, what about meat?
She and other scientists were particularly curious about meat because protein-rich foods may have been key to the evolution of large, complicated human brains.
To power these big machines in our head, we need a lot of energy. So of course, we need high-quality, energy-rich foods.
Recently, she and some colleagues developed a highly sensitive new kind of chemical analysis, one that can reveal a carnivore lifestyle. It involves detecting very, very small amounts of nitrogen in tiny amounts of organic material. The researchers have just used it to study an ancient human ancestor, Australopithecus, which lived around 3 million years ago.
These are still fairly ape-like, small-brained hominins that already walked upright but had like a more ape-like walk, basically.
Stone tools and cut marks on bones from their time period suggested that they might have been meat eaters. So Ludica went to a collection of remains found in a South African cave and nabbed bits of tooth enamel from teeth that belonged to 7 individuals.
So I actually have a normal dental drill and go with that in the collection after all the permits are granted, which is hard to get.
Her team ran its lab tests, comparing these teeth to results from known carnivores and herbivores. Lo and behold,
our study now shows actually that all of these 7 individuals were probably not engaging in a lot of meat consumption. So these were plant eaters mostly.
The results are described in the journal Science. She says they set a kind of baseline.
So here for the first time, we have actual numbers to put it on there to say like, okay, not much meat was consumed for these small-brained hominins. But then what happened after, right?
She wants to do the same kind of testing on other past human relatives, moving up the evolutionary chain. That sounds pretty awesome to Bernard Wood. He's a paleoanthropologist at the George Washington University who wasn't part of this research group. He thinks this is one of the biggest advances in this field in years.
It means that one can look at other hominins and try and do the same sorts of measurements and get a sense of what they were consuming during life.
For example, he wonders about Homo habilis, an extinct human species that lived about 1.5 to 2.5 million years ago.
It would be great to know whether Homo habilis was eating as much meat as some people think it was, but I have my doubts.
His sense is that very early human species might be more vegetarian. And now researchers have a new way to check. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
News of a ceasefire and hostage release deal between Israel and Hamas spread quickly through U.S. college campuses, which have been bitterly divided over the conflict in Gaza since October 7th, 2023. NPR's Tovia Smith checked in with several students.
When Maya Goel, a sophomore at Wayne State University in Detroit, first heard about the deal, she headed straight for Hillel, the Jewish student organization, both nervous and excited.
We just talked about all the hostages and how happy their families will be to have them back.
But Goel also worries about the price Israel may pay to get back the 33 promised hostages. It would free about 1,000 Palestinian detainees and prisoners, including some convicted of killing Israelis. That's especially hard to accept, Goel says, knowing that the October 7th mastermind, Yahya Sinwar, was one of the prisoners released in a hostage swap years ago.
It is a high price to pay. Like, who knows who these prisoners that are going to be released and who knows what they're going to do in the future. I feel like it's a no-win situation.
Several other students expressed similar dismay, but they're somewhat more optimistic about implications on campuses where tensions have been roiling. Boston University senior Akiva Zeff says he hopes the deal could shift focus away from some of the most incendiary accusations like genocide and war crimes.
I can only hope that this simmers down because it's very charged and that removes a lot of nuance from what is an exceptionally nuanced situation.
The sentiment was shared by MIT senior Alex Edwards. Walking past the spot, he recalls was packed last year with encampments, protesters, and police.
We were just like, whoa, what the hell is going on? This is insane.
I'm just here to learn, Edwards says, and the protests are a distraction.
I don't think demanding that MIT cuts ties with Israel is going to change Israel's policies.
But many of those leading campus protests say they have no intention of letting up. Mahmoud Muhaisin co-founded the Muslim Coalition at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. If anything, he says he's now fired up by a deal he sees as a big win.
When it happened, I went with a couple of friends and we drove around honking with the Palestinian flag and went and got sweets for all my coworkers and enjoyed the moment.
Now, Muhaisin says the student movement must and will continue.
The message is that this didn't start on October 7, and the fight for justice doesn't end on January 15.
Muhaisin says more than 24 students are planning to run for positions within Michigan's state Democratic Party, since he says National Democrats betrayed them. The fight is ramping up, he says, not winding down.
It would be a shame for all the sacrifice and all the martyrdom that happened inside of Gaza to go in vain.
Barnard College junior Marie Adele Grasso agrees. She says a ceasefire has been top priority for pro-Palestinian activists like her. Once that's achieved, she says, they can focus on the rest of their agenda.
For divestment and keep pushing for the U.S. government to stop funding Israel. And we will be working hard on explaining more complex settler colonial violence, and hopefully people will keep showing up.
As a rallying cry, that may not resonate quite like calls for a ceasefire did, but it may end up spurring more serious and productive conversations about complex and nuanced issues that, many students agree, is sorely needed. Tobia Smith, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles, where the vast majority of people have not had to evacuate their homes during these wildfires. That's something you might not understand from watching all the media coverage, images of homes burning, people fleeing in distress. Now, tens of thousands of people did have to evacuate, but there are about 10 million people living in the Los Angeles area. Katia Riddle covers mental health, and she's been reporting on these fires. And she's joining me now to talk about the many, many Angelenos who did not have to evacuate, including myself, and the very complicated emotional experience that we are going through right now. Hi, Katia.
Hi, Elsa.
So I know that you've been here now for several days reporting on these fires. What got you interested in this particular aspect of the story?
It started for me when I flew in. I knew, of course, rationally that the whole city was not on fire, but when I looked out over the landscape as I landed at LAX, it just looked so calm and peaceful, and it seemed so surreal to me to be contrasting the destructive images I'd seen with the sort of business as usual portion of the city that I saw from the airport. That said, nearly everyone I've talked to here has either themselves been hit by tragedy or know someone that has been hit by tragedy of varying degrees. It's sort of concentric circles of trauma, depending on how close you are to the Palisades or Altadena. Many people have said things like, I feel bad because my house is still standing and my neighbor lost everything. There's a real sense of survivor's guilt among many people here.
Exactly. It's this sick combination of guilt and relief and fear that I could be next. Like, if not now, at some point. And you keep imagining, what would it be like to lose everything? How would I bear it? And then you're like, okay, stop. Stop, Elsa, you're okay. Just stop. Do something useful. Stop looping. I mean, what do we do with all these feelings of helplessness and guilt right now? Because I'm fried and I never even evacuated.
I talked to a psychiatrist who is the director of emergency psychiatry at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. His name is Jace Reed. He explained that it's very important for people to honor their own experiences in these moments. Even if, for example, your house is still standing, but your neighbor's is not, there's real grief in losing your neighborhood. And there's real grief for anyone in LA watching this happen to their city. And it's important to acknowledge feelings without comparing them. We are not in a suffering Olympics. It doesn't mean that we can't continue to support or help others who need it. But he stressed that for people recovering from this kind of trauma, whether it's direct or secondary, part of the healing process is allowing yourself to do the things that you enjoy.
Some things that you can do is be okay to take time to feel happy, to find joy in little things. A lot of people during these stressful times feel like they have to be sad. They have to be worried about something, but it's okay to find that joy. Those are normal things to experience during this time.
God, that is so helpful, because it was my birthday this past weekend, and I did feel guilty for celebrating quietly with a few friends. You know, it felt like frivolous, kind of tone deaf. And I also recognize how much I badly needed community and connection and how much I needed to laugh. And I imagine there are a lot of people out there who are feeling some version of this. Am I allowed to be happy when there's so much trauma and grief around us?
Yes. In fact, Reed was emphatic about the need to really moderate news consumption and prioritize other things like a birthday party.
We feel like we need to consume more and more of the information. And a lot of it has very traumatic images. Scary things for all of us. And we may find ourselves caught in a cycle of just rewatching the same thing over and over, getting more and more worried.
So if you find that images on TV or social media are getting you really upset, psychologists say you should note how these things are making you feel physically. You know, are your shoulders hunching? Is your heart racing? And take a breath and a break from it.
Yeah, cut yourself some slack. It's okay to take care of yourself so you can take care of other people later, right?
Exactly.
That is NPR's Katia Riddle. Thank you so much, Katia.
Thank you, Elsa.
As the climate warms, it's getting harder for people in colder parts of the country to count on the right weather for traditional winter sports, things like outdoor ice skating. In Maine, those skating enthusiasts delighted this month in a string of cold, snowless days that froze lakes, ponds, even some rivers. Maine Public Radio's Ari Snyder laced up his skates and joined the wild ice bonanza.
Frank Whittier says he's been hitting the ice near his home in southern Maine a lot recently.
It's truly panic mode. Everybody's like texting, and where are you going? I have a, one friend who went three times yesterday, three different lakes, just chasing black ice.
Black ice. Whittier is not referring to the roadway hazard, but rather to smooth, clear ice, unblemished by snow or rain or thaw. For outdoor ice enthusiasts like Whittier, it's the holy grail.
It is absolutely like a glass carpet out there. It's crazy, crazy beautiful.
And he's not the only one dropping everything to get after it.
How you feeling, better?
Yeah.
First time all year, right?
Stu Strawbridge has pulled his fourth grade daughter Nina out of school for a session on nearby Runaround Pond.
I mean, we usually get it once a year, maybe twice, but right now we've got a stretch. It looks like it might last like 15, 20 days.
Yep. Bend those knees, remember? Just like as if you're pushing a chair, yeah. Remember, you got some big bumps over there.
On another lake not far off, Marina Gray is cutting a swift upwind line across the glassy surface.
It's kind of effortless almost, and I'm sure, you know, once the wind pushes me back, I probably will have to do like 10% effort to try to really get some speed.
Gray says she fell in love with outdoor ice skating as a kid. Now she says she's something of an evangelist.
I'm trying to get all my friends to go out. My friend with me today, she actually just bought her skates an hour ago.
This is how most information travels in the wild ice community. A tip from a friend, a video dropped in the group chat, or a detailed scouting report posted on Facebook. The ever-shifting nature of the ice is part of the thrill, but it's also part of the risk. Even today, under sterling conditions, those who venture to the northern reaches of this lake return with warnings of open water. Gray wears a pair of ice picks around her neck in case she breaks through.
Just something about being on a frozen lake seems kind of daring, and I don't know, I like to push the limits and enjoy the elements outside.
Let's stay in touch, because I could easily...
But those elements are changing. Maine winters are getting warmer and more erratic due to climate change. Frank Whittier at the pond near Portland says he's seen it firsthand.
We're truly cherishing this moment, but we're not getting as many of them. Our lakes are unequivocally not freezing as much in the winter.
That means when the ice is this good, there's no time to waste.
All right, so see if we could get out of here, get some clean wind.
In the waning daylight, Whittier steps onto a sort of skateboard with metal runners instead of wheels, lifts a handheld sail overhead, and glides away. For NPR News, I'm Ari Snyder in southern Maine.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options, designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at...
What? 6 o'clock already?
Yeah, man.
Get up, 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 get up.
On Nerds.